I go out there and I blow it. I could have very easily turned that into a nightmare. I tried my best not to. It wasn't easy. I mean, I'm not saying it was an easy thing just to blow that off, but there was also a lot of things that I could take away from that hunt and make me better.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to episode 147. Our guest for this episode is Steve Flores. He has an interesting perspective on hunting whitetails as he does it in the Appalachians of the eastern United States and hunts mountain whitetails. Steve has also taken that experience out west and become an elk hunter. So we talk a bit about whitetail hunting, some of the tactics that he employs, and then how he translates that into western hunting and hear about his experiences hunting elk as well. So whether you're an East Coast guy, Western hunter, deer, elk, you name it, there's something in this show for you. Before we dive into that conversation, wanted to thank Daniel Boucher for sending us an episode topic suggestion for a future show. And Daniel, we want to send you some Exo Mountain Gear and Hunt Backcountry podcast swag, so send us your shipping information. Listeners, if you want to enter into these giveaways, it's simple. We just want to hear from you. You can send us an episode or topic suggestion by email to podcast@exomountaingear.com, or you can leave us your feedback and review in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you might be listening to this. All right, let's dive into this conversation with Steve Flores. Steve, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And Steve Speck, co-host Steve Speck. How you doing tonight, man?
I'm good, man.
Well, Steve, I'd love just to kind of start with some introduction and background just to give our listeners context. If you could kind of give us a little bit of history with hunting and, you know, you've been involved in different ways in the industry and things like that. And then we'll kind of dive into some topics. That'd be great.
Sure, sure. I started freelance outdoor writing about 8 or 10 years ago, and it's kind of how I guess you could say I got my foot in the door within the industry per se, and wrote for a lot of the magazines and kind of carried that over into digital format online, and I've written for several web pages, bowhunting.com. I was their editor for a while and just started freelancing with different places online that needed content, and just went from there. And I've hunted my whole life in West Virginia in the mountains, and my biggest thing was trying to figure out how to hunt whitetail in the mountains when nobody was, you know, really talking about it. There's really nowhere to go to get information on how to do that kind of thing. So just, that's basically what I cut my teeth on, just trying to chase down these, what I like to call mountain bucks. I've been learning every year from that. It's a never ending process.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I mean, we have listeners as we talk about backcountry hunting, you know, all over the place. Obviously, mm-hmm. plenty of guys out west and the guys back east, Midwest, Canada. I mean, there's listeners all over the place. And, you know, we've sure. gotten so much requests from some of the guys who don't live out west and want to hunt out west. And some of those guys were bringing up great points, like, what about finding opportunities where you're at? You know, whether you're on the East Coast, wherever you're at, to kind of do these mountain-style type hunts. And, mm-hmm. you know, you've you've done that a bit with what you do with Whitetail, which I want to talk about. And then you've also now in the past few years gotten to hunt the West. And so I'm really curious to not only hear about your experiences hunting Whitetail in the mountains, in the Appalachians, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So hunting Whitetail there, which is totally different than kind of the typical Whitetail hunt that we think of. But then I'd also want to hear how that translates into Western hunting. And so that's kind of the direction that I'd like to head. But go ahead and kind of give us some context. I mean, you mentioned hunting these mountain bucks is kind of, there's not a lot of information out there. There wasn't before you got going and started sharing some of it, at least. But kind of tell us kind of high level, like, what are the differences with the way that you've been hunting whitetail compared to what most of us think when we hunt whitetail hunting?
Oh, there's so many differences in between, hunting in the mountains for whitetail in the Midwest. You know, I grew up reading, Bill Winky was my favorite outdoor writer, and he's just a master at not only writing, but just his tactics and stuff for Midwestern whitetail. And so I grew up just trying to get as much information as I could off of Winky to try to apply that to the way I hunt. And the thing that I discovered was it doesn't work. You know, I'm using different puzzle pieces and different, it didn't work. And the main thing that I found was, you know, for Midwestern whitetail, you pretty much have a predominant feeding area and, you know, a bedding area, and getting in between is, you know, I don't have a lot of experience hunting Midwestern deer, but from the outside looking in, it seems, you know, the key is to get in between bedding and feeding and find a good trail, pinch point, and there you go. But for me in the mountains, these deer bed and feed in a lot of different areas, and they change depending on the cover, depending on hunting pressure, depending on, mast crops. And it there's so many different variables that went into what the puzzle that I was trying to figure out, you know, and using things from the Midwest just didn't work. It didn't work for me. Playing the wind, you know, just off the top of my head, playing the wind was one of those big things that I always tried to do. But it's nearly impossible to do where I live and hunt to play the wind. I mean, you just can't do it.
What's been your strategy to get around that? The second you say that, it reminds me, like, some of our elk hunts, you know, just especially this last year, like afternoon storms roll in and mm-hmm. you're, there's nothing you can do. You walk 100 yards with the wind in your face, and then the next 100 yards, wind's at your back, going the same direction.
The thing that I realized what I had to do was just become an absolute fanatic when it came to controlling my scent, my odor. Mm-hmm. And I mean, taking it just to the extreme. Still, even with doing all that, I'm not going to fool the deer's nose. I mean, I honestly believe he's still going to smell me, but the philosophy that I've came up, that I've tried to take is, it's okay if he smells me because I know he's going to, but when he does smell me, I want him to think that I'm 200 yards away and not 20 yards away, you know, at full draw. I do think it's possible to dilute your scent down to a certain level to where, yeah, they may get a hint of you, but it's not enough to alarm them. That's the philosophy I take. Sometimes the wind is in my favor, you know, when I'm hunting around, sometimes it is in my favor, but more than not, it changes all day. It changes, you know, from one minute to the next. So it's just something I've had to deal with.
Yeah. So what are your like top five things that you've done to reduce, you know, you said be a fanatic. Well, I mean, if you're trying to reduce that, what's the top ones?
I usually start about a month out from the season, and I start, of course, everybody uses, you know, scent-free soap before a hunt. Mm-hmm. But, you know, about a month out from opening day, I stop using any kind of scented soap. I don't use any cologne. I don't use any, you know, shaving cream, anything that has any type of scent to it. I won't put it on my body. And I start with that, make sure all, you know, make sure all of my clothes are clean, kept tight, packed away. No air can get to them. I don't wear my hunting clothes in my vehicle. I even have a separate set of clothes that I keep clean that I travel in. If I have to drive to my hunting area, those are the clothes that I'll wear that, you know, they're kept clean and in a scent proof bag. And that's what I wear. And I dress outside of my vehicle. I won't even wash my hands with scented soap. I mean, I try to get scent free soap that I can do everything I need to do from September to December. And that's what I won't wear any clothes that have been washed in regular detergent or anything. I try to just remain as scent free as I can. Sometimes I'll use chlorophyll pills. I've used those before. They seem to fight the bacteria from within, from the inside out. Not only on the outside of your skin. One thing I know a lot of guys do is they'll take their scent-free shower, grab that towel that their wife washed for them that's got downy all over it, and they'll dry off on it. And to me, I don't have any doubt in my mind that a mature whitetail can smell that. When you put that towel on your wet skin with that that's been washed in downy or whatever, it's going to leave that residue on your body, in my opinion. And I just think, you know, just little things like that. I'll change out the wrist strap on my release that I've shot with all summer. I'll take that off and put a new one on. But it's just, you know, making sure I don't contaminate myself with anything in my day-to-day life, you know, not just wait until, okay, it's Friday, you know, it's the weekend, I'm going to go hunt. Now I'm going to use scent-free soap and do that. Because I think that it's, you know, if you've only got one night to combat everything you've done all week, as far as putting all those scents on your body, I think it's just you're asking a lot from your products.
Now, did you see a noticeable result with becoming a fanatic like that in your hunting?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, and early on, you know, I mean, I've always been that way, but you know, I think once early on, I was using the carbon line clothing when it first came out. And, you know, this is not a knock against those types of clothing, but in the early years and early stages of that clothing, they were meant to do one thing, and that was just try to trap your scent. They weren't meant to keep you very warm. They weren't meant to, you know, lift perspiration off your body. And I know that those companies have come a long way since the early years, but after so long of using that those products and not being able to stay warm and not being able to, you know, hunt the way I wanted to hunt, I kind of got away from those and just started using, you know, basically a lot of the clothing that they use out west to hunt with. So when I did that, I knew that I couldn't cut corners with my scent control. You know, there was times that whenever I was using carbon activated clothing and I might try to cut corners here and there, or I'd get lazy and, you know, slip here and there as far as what I was doing, you know, to my body or the odors I was putting on myself. But once I kind of got away from those types of clothing, I knew that I would have to cross my T's and dot my I's. So, but yeah, I did notice a noticeable difference. You know.
Yeah. Getting in and doing all this process before the hunt begins, what's your approach with getting to your hunting location? Cause you know, it doesn't take long to get up a steep climb on a ridge, even, you know, on a good Appalachian mountain out east, to get some sweat building up. Is your sole approach there to just not start warm so that you're not sweating right away? Or do you go to other extreme measures there to not build up, you know, perspiration and scent as you're getting into your hunting area?
What I like to do is I usually carry a big backpack in, you know, I look like I'm going out west for a hunt usually when I'm going into whitetail hunt, but I like to have a big backpack, and I like to put 90% of my clothes in there. I mean, the only thing I'll wear up top will be just a base layer. But everything else will go in my pack. And I try to start out cold. I don't like to start out, you know, already warm or wear all of my clothing, which, you know, a lot of guys, I think, have went to that. They're not, they know enough to know not to wear all their hunting clothes on the walk in. But I just try to stay as cool as I can. Take my time, give myself enough time to get to my stand at a slow pace. If I'm trying to beat the sunrise going in, I know I'm going to work up a sweat, which I get. I get giddy when I'm headed to the stand anyway. It doesn't take much to work up a sweat because I'm just excited to get out. I just, you know, basically put all of my clothes inside my pack and strap everything down. And when I get to where I'm going, by the time I take the pack off and get all of my clothes sorted out and laid out on the ground, I'm starting to cool down. And I'll do that. If it's 20 degrees, if it's snowing or raining, I usually just walk in with a base layer on, and that usually keeps me warm. And I like to keep a spare base layer with me and a large plastic bag, just in case in the early season, if I get really sweaty going in, I'll just take that base layer off and put it in a Ziploc bag and put a dry one on and go from there.
One last question. Do you, scent spray there, like at the trailhead? I'm always a major skeptic that actually does any substantial, you know, makes any substantial difference. What's your thoughts on that?
I like to use, Scent Blocker had a body gel that they made for years. And I, what it was is I put that on immediately after I got out of the shower. And what it was supposed to do was prevent the growth of bacteria on your skin. So I was a big believer in that. I mean, I would cover myself in this stuff just because, you know, I knew I was going to sweat, but if I could keep that sweat from breaking down later and then turning into bacteria and putting off an odor, then that was what I was trying to do. I haven't been able to find that anymore. I don't think they make it anymore. So I've been using a dead downwind version of it. I think it works. I mean, would I say, yeah, that is the absolute key to everything? No, but it's all of these little pieces put together that make the difference, I think. But yeah, that's one thing I really like to make sure that I have is some sort of body foam or body lotion that's designed to kill that bacteria that's before it starts to form on your body from sweat. That's probably the main thing I try to look for and try to make sure that I do before I head out. Yeah,
it's wild. Like, you know, when you have the ability to have this control versus when you're on a backpack hunt, you can't do anything.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you can't do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I've done both, you know, living in Missouri and whitetail hunting. Like, I've tried to do some pretty strict scent control and have questioned that. But I'm kind of like you were saying, Steve, I think the more you can do is better. But it's almost like if you're going to take this middle of the road approach and like do some things but not others, you're kind of just wasting your time. Because there are so many contaminant scents that it's like if you're not doing a scent-free shower and not doing the scent-free towel afterwards and you're just showing up in stinky clothes and spraying some spray on, you're just wasting money. But if you put this whole system together, maybe you're doing something a bit more effective. And then on the flip side of that, you know, going out west and going to elk hunt, it's like, well, nothing matters, you know?
I would agree with that. It's hard, you know, and I try to make sure that I've got my side-by-side filled up with gas or my vehicle filled up with gas so that when I get in the vehicle, you know, when I drive off in the morning, I don't have to make any stops. It's just straight to my hunting area. I don't stop and get breakfast. I don't get, you know, go into the, you know, order frying bacon or anything, you know, but you're right. All of that stuff put together will make a difference. I truly believe, but if you're going to cut corners, you're just shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
With your personal experience going out west then, you have that mindset of you're pretty much not even going to try this? Because we get questions all the time on, you know, do we think scent control works? And what about guys who may be going on their first hunt and they're used to doing this whole type of routine and they're thinking, well, what the heck am I going to do when I'm out west? I can't do my routine. And there's all kinds of thoughts on that. But what was your personal approach when you were kind of headed out west? Did you try to pull off any of this?
I'm not a Western hunter expert by any means, but my good friend Marcus Flesher lives in Idaho, and actually when he invited me out, you know, that was one of the first things that came to my mind was, okay, I got to get my scent gear out there with me. I've got to get, you know, my products. And he said, dude, don't even waste your time with it. You know, he said, 4 days on the mountain and it ain't gonna matter. You know, you're not gonna be able to fool anything. But I still tried to, you know, I still kept all of my hunting gear scent free. You know, I still went through my basic whitetail routine, and I thought, you know, if I show up, having done that, that would be, but you know, in my, I just couldn't handle the idea of not preparing to be scent free and going out there anyway. I couldn't do it. So right. I went through my regular whitetail routine and just went ahead and went with it. And, you know, once I got there, you know, Marcus's, he's grabbing gas cans with these hunting gloves, and I'm like putting on rubber gloves, and he's like, dude, what are you doing? I'm like, man, I can't touch that can with my hunting clothes. I can't do it. You know, he got a big kick out of it, but
that's funny.
We say
all the time that confidence is everything, and hey man, whatever gives you confidence, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So another lesson I'd like to kind of pull with your approach with whitetail hunting and kind of the terrain that you hunt, maybe connect the dots for some of our listeners. How do you see terrain? How do you look at scouting, kind of putting the picture together on how these bucks might be moving? You mentioned that it's not the typical Midwest whitetail move from feed to bed, you know, go through a pinch row to a crop, what have you. So what did you learn hunting mountain whitetail? How do you see terrain? How do you look at movement and behavior of these animals? And then maybe how does that apply to your Western approach?
The main thing that I've taken away from just my experiences with them is, you know, these mountain bucks are so hard. A mature one especially is just so hard to kill and to get on that I had to, for me, I thought it was better to pick the one time or the one area that they were the most vulnerable in. And for me, and for most deer hunters, you know, I know a lot of deer hunters would probably agree that during the rut was the easiest time to, you know, get on one of these bucks without completely, you know, giving up your hand, letting him know that you're hunting him. So for me, I had to locate the does, which, you know, it's not rocket science, but what I used to do early on was I would find a good spot, you know, find a place that had a lot of does, and I would hunt that spot as many times as I could, as often as I could, from opening day right on up through the rut, you know, and naively thinking that, okay, if I just put in enough time, sooner or later I'm going to shoot a big buck. And it just didn't happen that way. Mainly because I was burning out those stands before the rut even started. It's just so difficult when does or when deer are bedding and feeding in a lot of different areas, it's so difficult to go through an entire season, you know, 2 or 3 month season without disturbing them, without letting them know that you're there. So, you know, by the time the rut would kick in, the does already knew what was going on. They knew I was in the area. They knew I was going in and out. And of course, they'd move on and take the bucks with them. And, you know, I would see, you know, immature bucks at best. So I had to get the mindset, okay, I've got one really good week out of the year. That's the only time I'm going to hunt these stands. Once I find, you know, once I go through the process of locating does and the pinch points of that, I've got, once I do narrow all that down to one stand position, I've got to stay out of that until, you know, for me, it's like the second week of November. And once I started doing that, that's when I really started seeing my success rate take off with mature bucks and not just burning these stands out. So, you know, I had to get stands that I would hunt early season and stands that I'd set aside for the rut. And that was the biggest key for me. And then, you know, once I located a pocket of does, it was, to me, it was like, okay, now that there's the does, there's what the bucks are going to be coming after November, but you've got an entire mountainside of terrain. How are you going to pick the one tree that buck's going to walk by out of all these trees? How do you pick the right one? And for me, it was just basically looking at areas where easy terrain and hard terrain butted up against each other. In other words, you know, if I was looking at a topo map and all of the terrain was fairly open, if a deer did move through that area, he could move in a bunch of different places. You know, it'd be hard to pinpoint down, you know, exactly where he's going to move through. But if I found an area where there was some easy terrain and then it pinched down and butted up against some tough terrain, something that was steep, then I could predict almost, you know, where that buck was going to move, because I knew he would try to stay on the path of least resistance, and knowing that would a lot of times tell me which direction he was going to go. So I would try to set up in those areas, find a good stand. And most of the time if I'd find those spots on a map, I could go in, you know, boots on the ground, and usually 9 times out of 10, there'd be some good trails that would, you know, back up what I was thinking on the map.
Yeah, kind of that point where the path of least resistance is also against terrain that provides security and cover, the combination of the two.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of times these, you know, the thing of, you know, if I did a lot of that, if I found areas like that with early season when the canopy was still heavy and there was a lot of leaves on, you know, when those leaves drop, those paths will change. Those trails will change. I mean, they'll find better routes that keep them hidden, you know, when there's no leaves on, you know. And I used to do my scouting right before the season, you know, and I've come to realize that, you know, that's pretty much, unless you're going to hunt, you know, right off the bat, immediately hunt that stand, it's not going to do you any good, you know, a month and a half into the season when the leaves are gone, because that deer is not going to, you know, the cover changes, he's not going to take that same trail. So I do a lot of my scouting right after the season, right this time of year, right now, when there's no leaves on, because I want to see how they're using the lay of the land when there's no leaves on and it's strictly using the terrain to stay hidden, or to move through an area.
Great advice.
So when I think of the hunting that you're doing, again, kind of comparing this to the standard whitetail hunting that many people think of, and tying this into Western hunting, something that I think you're dealing with more than the average whitetail hunter is simply a numbers game. There's probably fewer deer. There's larger tracts of land in terms of cover. So these deer are a bit more spread out, at least visibly. You probably don't have the visibility that your average hunter, you know, over CRP or crop or what have you, is going to have. How does that play into things like mindset? Because it can be tough, I would assume, to stay in it and to stay confident and to stay engaged. And I think that you learning that lesson can apply to a lot of guys who maybe go out west and maybe go through days, like a whole day or maybe 3 days of not seeing an elk or not seeing a mule deer or what have you, when maybe they're used to hunting, you know, Midwest whitetail and seeing a dozen deer every time they go for a sit.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's days, there's times that I'll hunt 2 or 3 days and not see a deer. And I guess I just, I've grown used to it since it's all I've ever known. Because yeah, I mean, here the deer, you know, deer could be 100 yards from you and you never see him. It's certain areas he could be 50 yards from you, you know, and slip by and you'd never see him. Either because the terrain is just, you know, the it's so thick, or you might be hunting just on the crest of a point and he's on the other side from you, 50 yards away, and you may be able to hear him, but can't see him, or the leaves are wet. You're not going to hear him at all. So I guess it's just something that I got used to growing up, and, you know, and it definitely helped when I went out west and, you know, we'd go half a day or a day. I know my first year out there, out west with Marcus, we had a spell there. We went a couple of days and didn't see an elk. And it was just like business as usual to me. You know, it was, I just knew that from my experience hunting bucks here, you just got to stay with it. You got to stay in the game. Cause if, you know, you can't kill anything if you're at camp, basically. The thing that's helped me the most hunting whitetail here has just been scouting cameras. If I can get a few pictures here and there of a buck and I know he's there, and I know that I'm sitting on a good pocket of does that are undisturbed, you know, if they're undisturbed, the bucks are going to come, their bucks will find them. All I got to do is just hang tight and just let them do their thing. But yeah, if I've got some, I really rely on scouting camera pictures. If I can just get a picture or two of a buck and know that he's there, I'll just dig in like a tick and wait him out. that's basically, you know, because if you can't see him on the hoof, you know, if you're not seeing, you know, you're not seeing these deer on the hoof, it can get hard. It can wear you down and make you give up, but I've just learned just stay with it. You know, if you've got a good spot and some good does that aren't, nobody's pushed them, bumped them, then it'll happen.
Yeah. So besides that kind of mindset resiliency piece, what other things do you think the hunting lessons you learned over the years hunting these mountain bucks, what other things helped you for transitioning to Western hunting?
Well, I think you got to be in shape. You know, you got to be in really good shape to do this. You don't have to be in good shape to participate in hunting out here, but it helps tremendously. And I know you guys are aware that, you know, how the fitness mindset is transferred over into the hunting world now. You know, it's a pretty big thing. I've been doing that. We've been doing that here, you know, most of my life. There's a lot of reasons how, you know, being in shape actually helps you out here. You know, the better shape you're in, the easier the climb is going to be. The easier the climb, the less sweat, less odor. I mean, it just all ties in together. And if you're in good shape, you know, when you look at hunting mountain bucks, most of your hunters are going to go to those easy to reach places. And if you've got the vast majority of the hunting population that are going to these easy to reach places, it only makes sense to me that the majority of your bigger bucks are going to go to the places that aren't easy to reach because that's where less amount of pressure is. So if I'm in shape, and there's been seasons that I wasn't in shape and I didn't want to go into those hard to reach places, you know, I didn't do as well. But when I'm in shape, it's easier to go to those places where the mature bucks are going to go, because they know where a lot of the hunters won't go, and that's where they like to hang out. So staying in shape for mountain bucks, you know, it's just like, you know, why you guys in the out west try to stay in shape. Because if you can go further and deeper and longer, I mean, it just increases your odds of success. It's the same thing back here, even though we're hunting whitetail. To a Midwestern guy, I don't think, you know, I would assume that they don't put much thought into being physically prepared for the season. And that's not a knock against those guys. It's just their demands and their obstacles aren't like ours, you know, in the East or even out West are.
What surprised you the most about the transitioning to Western hunting?
Shot range.
Yeah.
Open terrain, judging a shot, you know, at an elk standing in a meadow, you know, at 10,000 feet, you know, here everything's pretty in your face. I mean, a 40 yard shot is a long shot for me, just because of the underbrush is so thick in a lot of the areas I hunt. It's just, you know, you're not gonna get a long shot. So yeah, just trying to transition for that mindset of, you know, being good at 30, 40 yards. Okay. Now being good at 70 yards, with a bow, that was probably the hardest thing for me. Mm-hmm. And also the first year I went to Idaho, I had multiple pin sight, which I haven't used in 30 years. I've always been a one pin sight guy for the way I hunt. There's no reason to have more than one pin, or really two at the most, because most of my shots are going to be 30 yards in. And if I usually just use one pin and set it at 25, and I'm usually good. So the first year I went out West, I had all these pins in my face, and I'm not blaming my what happened to me the first year I went out there on my pins, but I shot right through the antlers of a big 6x6, which had nothing to do with the pins staring back at me, but it didn't help. Didn't help much for me.
It might have had something to do with that big old 6x6.
Yeah, I think it had more to do with the, yeah, with all those points rather than all those pins. Yeah, so when I went back this past year, I went back to my single pin, and I just really, really liked that better.
Man, what did you learn from that first hunt and kind of botching that shot? Was that tough to bounce back from?
It was pretty tough. You know, it was, I guess I knew that it was out of my system, and I knew enough about myself to know that, okay, I've got that out of my system. Now the next time is going to be different. Because I've made that mistake before. You know, I prepared for so many different things on that hunt. I mean, physically and gear, and I prepared for everything. But that's, you know, when you see a bull elk for the very first time, and you pull your bow back on him, and there's really not a lot that can prepare you for that. And, you know, I just choked. Basically just choked. I mean, there's no other excuse for it. But I, you know, like I said, I knew that, given another chance, it would be different. It did work out, you know, it worked out good. The next opportunity I had worked out differently, but it was tough. You know, I had a lot of guys that seemed to find enjoyment in, giving me a hard time over it, which was fine, you know. I kind of used to be one of those guys that would give somebody a hard time whenever a hunt didn't turn out like they planned. But I learned a long time ago that usually comes back around to you. So
yeah,
I don't go down that path anymore.
When you said that about those guys giving you a hard time, I was literally thinking they're the guys who probably haven't been there, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't mean been there as in not botched a shot. I mean, been there has probably not been in that situation with a big old elk, you know?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it took several years for me to condition myself to pull through a shot on a good whitetail. I mean, I wasn't bored like that and just, you know, ice in my veins, but, you know, it was just something I had to condition myself with. And, you know, I can say that I that's not to say I won't miss the next big whitetail I pull back on, but, you know, I'm pretty confident in my abilities to stay calm with a whitetail, but that elk stepped out and it was just, I was gone. I was lost.
Out of curiosity, when you say condition yourself, what are you doing, anything, at home or in your shooting practice to do that, to prepare for that? Is it just visualization
I tell you what I did a long time ago. I got a really bad case of target panic, I mean, it was to the point where I was actually ready to give up shooting a bow. That's how bad it had gotten. And of course, I'm a man of faith, and I try to tie that into all parts of my life when I can. And so, you know, long story short, I cut out a Bible verse and I had taped it to the riser of my bow. And what I did was, when I draw my bow back, before I would even pull the trigger, because that's what I'm going to do is punch the trigger as fast as I could. So I started to condition myself to recite this verse in my head, like so many times before I could even start putting my finger on the trigger, or so many times before I could even start to squeeze the trigger. And which you could do that with anything. You do with song lyrics or whatever, a quote, anything. But what I found was, for me, if I could get my brain to function and to occupy itself and to remember something and to actually process something during that moment when all it wanted to do was punch that trigger and get out of the situation, that I could slow everything down just enough to hold myself together to make a good shot. I think when for me, when you get in a pressure situation, you know, my mind knows, okay, as soon as I squeeze this trigger, this pressure situation is over. Good or bad, wherever my arrow goes, if it hits where I'm aiming or if it doesn't, it doesn't matter, because once I hit the trigger, then I'm out from underneath the stress that the shot's putting on me. So I would just draw back and try to get out of it as quick as I could and hit the trigger. But once I started engaging my mind in something, it would slow everything down just enough for me to concentrate to, you know, if I can concentrate enough to recite a scripture or a quote or a song verse in my head, then I can concentrate hard, you know, enough to pick that hair on that buck's chest that I want to split. That's what's worked for me.
It's a great tip.
You know, I've heard it said, and I've practiced it myself, to focus on the shot process itself, you know, to mm-hmm. mentally engage and go through like a shot sequence, a shot routine, mm-hmm. a shot process. But in a way, this is almost the opposite of that, because I mean, yes, you're still mentally engaged in something, but it's almost to take mm-hmm. your mind off of the shot process in a way, which is a pretty interesting dynamic. Yeah. I don't think that one is probably right or wrong. It's probably a matter of trying them and see what works for you. But it's an interesting thing, because so often the advice is focus on the shot, when in reality you're focusing on something other than the shot.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of archery. It's just so many different things. I mean, you know, we can both pick up the same bow and shoot it, and I love it and you hate it. Or, you know, five pins or one pin. It's so many different things, and there's so many, we all have our own opinions and likes and dislikes. And it's just, for me, you know, I spend months and months practicing the shot process, you know, finding my anchor, finding my, you know, picking the spot, letting the pin float, squeeze it. But then when I'd get in a high pressure situation, and all that junk goes out the door. I wouldn't remember any of it, because all I want to do is get out of the situation and hit that trigger. So, yeah, like I said, the trick was just, because I think muscle memory, my brain and my body's on autopilot. I know how to pull a bow back and an anchor and all that stuff. I don't need to remind myself to do it. What I needed to do was to remind my brain not to shut down and to stay in the moment long enough to pull that shot off and not try to get out of it. And that's just, I mean, that's just how it works for me.
Sticking on shooting just a bit, you kind of mentioned one of the kind of big surprises and things like that was just understanding shooting encounters out west, seeing that elk in the meadow and comparing that to, you know, the relatively short shots that you have in the tree stand. How does practice look differently for you if you're going on a western hunt? Like, besides extending your range and maybe just, you know, throwing out a target at 60 instead of 40, are there mm-hmm. any other shooting situations that you're practicing to prepare for a western hunt?
I did a lot of shooting from my knees, and I tried to do a lot of shooting under stress, under physical stress. I had a neighbor that kept a large section of the woodlot behind his home clear. So what I did was, you know, I did a lot of my training on that hill with a weighted pack, just going to make trips up and down, up and down, up and down. And I thought, well, I need to throw my shooting into this because, you know, when I draw my bow back, I want my heart to be beating fast because I know it's going to be beating fast when I see that elk. You don't get that from just getting out in the yard and, you know, getting on your knees at 70 yards and shooting. I wanted to see how I could handle shooting at 40 yards with my heart beating out of my chest. You know, I would do, you know, a couple trips up and down this mountain with my bow in my hand, my target already set up, and then I would stop about halfway up, grab an arrow and shoot it. I'd go on and do a couple more, and I would just progress through my quiver of arrows, and then once I was done, that would be my session. But that's how I tried to prepare as much as I could. It was just, like I said, from shots from my knees, which I wasn't, you know, the first year I went out to Idaho, those shots from my knees felt really awkward. It was like I almost couldn't get my balance. I couldn't, but after a while, I learned how to, you know, rest on my boots and where I needed my feet to be and how to, and I really, honestly, I'd almost rather shoot from my knees now than any position. I've just gotten so used to it. But yeah, just shooting under pressure, you know, shooting under physical stress was my main thing. Cause it's not like shooting here at a whitetail. I'm not usually under a lot of physical stress when I pull off a shot. I've been sitting in a stand for hours and, you know, I don't have a pack on my back. I'd shoot with my pack on my back. Just tried to make it as close to what it was going to be like out there as I could. I wish I would have found a way to better prepare my mind for that first shot because I'd give anything to have that one back. It was a nice bull.
Looking back at it now, do you think there is a better way to prepare for that?
If there is, I wouldn't know other than just trying to mentally talk to myself and, you know, and understand and realize what was going to happen. I think I was so focused on the physical preparation and making sure I had all of my gear, you know, because you guys know so much relies on your physical preparation, especially your gear out there. I mean, you know, you get on these Western hunts, your gear can be your life, you know, even, you know, how physically prepared you are for it. And I think I was so focused on all that maybe I just neglected to give enough mental preparation for, you know, what that was actually going to look like. I shot at an elk target all summer. I mean, I thought that having that in my sight picture would help. I just fell apart. Just didn't, you know, I guess it happens.
Yeah, it certainly does. Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah, it happens. But it was, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. I think you learn a lot. You know, I learned more from missing that elk than I did this past season when I connected on mine. You learn so much out of failure.
Man, that's such a helpful perspective. You know, it's so helpful, I'm sure, for many of our listeners to hear that and hopefully remember it, maybe if they botch an opportunity or something. But it's so true, you know, like, and that's how it should be with hunting, with this whole thing. It's, we like to take it serious, but at the same time, we just can't take it so dang serious all the time. And even when we jack it up, we just have to kind of be thankful for the opportunity and go, okay, what can I learn from this and how can I move on and get better, you know?
Exactly. You know, I mean, I had a lot, you know, I scraped and saved money to get out there, and my friend had basically given up his week of hunting just to try to get me on an elk. You know, I had a lot of people that helped me and was counting on me, and I go out there and I blow it, you know. And there was I could have very easily turned that into a nightmare, you know, afterwards. But like I said, I tried my best not to. It wasn't easy. I mean, I'm not saying it was an easy thing just to blow that off, but it, I knew that if I just sat down and took a look at it, there was a lot of things to be thankful for in that hunt, but there was also a lot of things that I could take away from that hunt and make me better for the next time, you know? So that's just, you know, the tragedy is just blowing it and then not getting any better afterwards.
Exactly. Blowing it and that's wasting it.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to wallow in the misery of a botched shot, then why not come out on the other? And when you get up out of it, why not be better than you were? You know, if you're not better than you were, then, you know, what's the point? You know, if I'm going to waller in it, I'm going to be a better person when I get out of it.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah.
I think it's an interesting opportunity as hunters to learn that lesson and probably learn it over and over again. And it just applies to everything in life because life's not fair. Yeah. You're going to get kicked in the nuts. You know what I mean? It's just going to happen. And like, as hunters, we have an opportunity to learn that lesson.
Exactly. And it, you know, and I really feel for these young hunters today. I mean, when I grew up hunting, I didn't grow up with the social media machine that we have now. And not that social media is a bad thing, but I think it adds a lot of pressure to younger hunters to try to keep up with everybody, you know. I mean, you've got to understand, you know, you've got to hunt. I went through that at one point. I thought that if I wasn't shooting the type of bucks that I was seeing in magazines or seeing on television, if I wasn't shooting those types of bucks every year, then was I really a hunter? You know, and I went through that phase, and it absolutely sucked the life out of everything, and it wasn't any fun, you know. And I mean hunting's supposed to be fun. So much more to it than the kill. I mean, you guys know that. I'm afraid a lot of these young hunters, you know, they miss that point. That, you know, you don't have to feel a tag to be successful or to have fun, or, you know, I'd love to see a lot of guys, you know, turn the mindset around to back to just going and having fun and not trying to, you know, outdo each other and competitions and, you know, how many likes can you get on a picture, or, you know, it's just, it'd be tough. I think it'd be tough to be a young hunter in this day and age.
Well, see, this has been great, man. We covered some really good ground. I really appreciate it. Is there anything else that you want to leave with the listeners or have them go check out, anything like that?
Like we just discussed, I mean, if you're going to, especially if you're hunting, you know, mountain bucks like I am, I mean, you got to understand you're hunting a completely different animal, and just being able to, you know, if you can get on a 3.5-year-old mountain buck, I like to think that that's the equivalent of a 6.5-year-old Midwestern buck. I mean, if they can live 3.5, you know, years in this terrain and the pressure that they see every day, that's a big accomplishment, you know, and that doesn't necessarily tie in with, you know, the headgear that's riding on top of their head. It's, you know, in my opinion, any buck in the mountains is something to be proud of. And something to cherish, because they're so hard to get on, and they're few and far between, and there's just, you're overcoming a lot of obstacles to get to that deer. So, you know, if it doesn't, don't think for one minute because it doesn't live up to the hype you see elsewhere that it's inferior, because it's not.
Right.
You know. Yeah, that's be my bit of advice. You know, if anybody's interested in tactics and things that I do, I've written for a lot of different web pages. You know, they can just Google my name. I've written on this subject a lot. Try to do it in magazines from time to time. I'm writing some stuff for AppalachianRange.com. I'll have some stuff on there soon. And DeerLab.com, we'll have some stuff coming out with them pretty soon too. Just some of the things I do and the way I try to approach things.
Perfect. Well, Steve, this has been great, awesome. Man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys. Really do.
Well, as always, thank you so much for tuning in. Don't forget to reach out, send us your suggestion for a future show topic, or give us your feedback. Leave us a review in iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us directly to podcast@exomountgear.com. Be sure to hit subscribe as well and join us next week.